Hello, everyone. Welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Monday, October 21st, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we are going to talk about the weekend's box office numbers. My name is Ben Pearson. I am an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film staff writer and box office analyst, Ryan Scott.
Hey, everyone. How's it going?
All right, Ryan, before we dive into the most recent weekend's top 10 at the box office, I thought it might be interesting to read just a quick listener email. So Charles, I don't know where Charles is from, but Charles sent us this email and he says, with the success of Terrifier 3, will we start seeing studios releasing unrated or NC-17 horror films? What do you think? So pretty broad question there, but do you think that the kind of astounding success of this really, really small movie could lead to studios taking more chances? Because as far as I understand it, Terrifier 3 is unrated. Is that right?
It is unrated, yes. So, this is interesting. So there's also, on a much smaller level, In a Violent Nature hit theaters earlier this year, unrated, and it did relatively well for what it was. You know, like, it didn't light up the box office or anything, but it made some money and put it on everyone's radar. And, you know, it's getting a sequel, so clearly Shudder and IFC were happy with those results. I think what's interesting is that the rating system is this sort of oddly outdated thing in modern viewing, where like movies are so ubiquitously available on Netflix and Hulu and everything else. So, and that Hulu and Disney Plus have melded together now for a lot of people. So you have a lot of this sort of R-rated mature content on Disney Plus in a lot of cases now. So, I don't know how much the rating stuff matters anymore beyond like being kind of maybe a marketing tool in this case. I could see some studios chasing that ball, but I will say in the lead up to Terrifier 3, Damien Leone, during the director and writer of the Terrifier franchise, he did an interview where he was saying that, you know, studios had approached him about doing like an R-rated version of Terrifier, like a remake of sorts. Because they saw this thing that was getting popular and they saw Art the Clown and they're like, well, how can we capitalize on this? Because clearly it's not the way that it's been going. And he said he kind of outwardly refused to do a lesser version because he sort of recognized that this thing has gotten popular by being what it is. And he proved very right, you know? So, I'm not sure. My gut tells me Hollywood is gonna have a hard time figuring out what the lesson is here.
Historically speaking, and you know much more about this, so please correct me if I'm wrong. My understanding is that historically speaking, studios have not really relied on the NC-17 or unrated ratings because a lot of theater chains wouldn't play those movies. And we're talking like years and years ago, decades ago at this point. And it was like tough to actually get movies shown that had those ratings. And that
I
seems
certainly
to not be the case anymore.
Yeah, I certainly think that used to be the case. And I think that maybe even before COVID, that would have been the case. It just wasn't a thing that came up really that often, you know. But I think now, I think what happened is that Terrifier 2 got a relatively wide release, but it was only supposed to be like a limited thing. And then it just did so well that everyone was like, well, what the hell is this? Okay, put it up on screen, you know, because in the aftermath of the pandemic, theaters still need a steady string of reliable stuff, so they're willing to put, like, you know, between anime or concert films or anything we've talked about, sort of specialty programming, they'll take more chances now simply because they need more reliable string of stuff that can deliver. So I think Terrifier 2 showed that was possible. So Terrifier 3 had a lot more theaters signed on initially, and then when Joker 2 bombed, a bunch of theaters were at it at the last second because everyone's like, well, we need something. You know, and then it really worked. And so Terrifier 3, which we'll get into in a minute, actually added theaters in its second weekend because once it, you know, debuted atop the box office, everyone's like, well, okay, let's go ahead and get in on what this is. So I think at this point, theaters aren't one to question the morality of a thing, right? They're like,
right,
look, we need money. So maybe that was a thing, and it certainly was a thing for a while. But again, that goes back to the idea that the rating system used to be a lot more important for, you know, dictating content in the era before streaming. And so I think, you know, because even when it came to renting something at a movie store or any of that stuff, that was an important distinction. And I just think those lines are much more blurry now. So yeah. Do I think this opens the door for more unrated stuff? Sure. Do I think that that's going to be a thing where the line is narrow as to where success can be? Yeah, because I think a lot of Terrifier is Art the Clown is really this like very identifiable and maybe the first new slasher icon we've had in a long time. And I think that you can't just sort of, you know, manufacture that. So mm-hmm. The gore and the shock value is certainly part of that equation, but there's probably a book to be written about this whole franchise's, you know, insane trajectory over the last decade. But yeah, so I do think what's going to happen is you probably get a studio or two that'll do like some, this is so shocking, you know, and they'll just give some director a bunch of money to do disgusting stuff. And, you know, whether or not that takes off, who knows? But so there'll probably be a couple of those, and then maybe studios go, well, that didn't work again. You know, and again, it's all, do you take the right lessons? Do you take the wrong lessons? I imagine it'll open up the door, and I imagine some waters will be tested. But what happens with that, I don't know.
Yeah. And I kind of think maybe for now, we should probably just like set our expectations at more of the independent type of stuff breaking into that realm in potentially wide releases and things like that, you know, like instead of actual movie studios deciding to fund and market an NC-17 or unrated thing, it seems much more likely that some scrappy upstart will come along and try to capitalize on that in their own way. So,
well, but what I think what it opens the door for then in that case is, yeah, you might have like independently produced unrated films that if they show promise enough, you might have, you know, maybe Universal Pictures has Blumhouse attached their name to it. I think Jason Blum has said something about not doing unrated movies, but in theory, you could have an acquisition by a major studio, right? If they go, all right, this mm-hmm. thing already exists, we can buy it for X amount, we take a shot on it. That's yeah. possible, you know.
Yeah, okay, all right. So thank you for sending in that email. You can email us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. If you have a question that you want us to talk about, we'll probably be glad to do that, depending on the question. All right, Ryan, so let's get into it. Why don't you hit me with the top 10 at the weekend's box office?
Would be my genuine pleasure, sir. All right, so... this weekend, these are estimates, by the way. The finals have not come in yet, so these numbers could fluctuate just a little bit. I like to preface that usually. But number one for the weekend, Smile 2, director Parker Finn's sequel to his 2022 breakout film, did $23 million, right in line with what the original did. Topped the charts, pretty much in line with expectations. All good news there. At number two was The Wild Robot, holding on to the number two spot in its fourth weekend. Killer legs on this one. Dropped just 28% in its fourth weekend for $10.1 million haul. It is coming up on the $200 million mark worldwide against a $75 million budget. It is in good shape. Terrifier 3, which we were just talking quite a bit about, fell to number 3 this weekend. Dropped a little less than 51% for a $9.3 million haul. It has made $36.2 million domestically through its first two weekends. For an unrated slasher with a budget under $3 million, that is insanely good. And the international grosses are starting to come in as well. So, yeah, it added 248 screens this weekend. Still had a stellar per screen average over $3,300. So it is killing it. At number four was Beetlejuice, which made $5 million in its seventh weekend, dropping just 32%. It is now at $284 million domestically, which is really great. It has made $434 million worldwide, so a little soft internationally, as we talked about, but still really well. This is going to become important in a second, though, and I will explain why. At number five, we had We Live in Time, the new A24 romance film featuring Florence Pugh and Andrew Garfield. It expanded into 985 screens this weekend and did $4.1 million. So it had a stellar per screen average, the second best in the top 20 behind only Smile 2. So that one, an expansion, is doing great and stands to do well over the next few weeks. At number six, we had Joker Folly Adieu, falling like a rock again in its third weekend, made just $2.1 million, dropped 69%. It shed over 1,200 screens, which we talked about last week might happen. It has a lousy $763 per screen average. Just an absolute catastrophe. It has made $56.4 million domestically, and it is probably not going to do a lot more than that. It will struggle to get to 60 at this point. The way things are going, it's bad. And number seven is Piece by Piece, the latest from Focus Features. That made $2.1 million in its second weekend. Not doing great. Dropped 45%. Kind of one of those okay-ish results. At number eight, we had Transformers 1 in its fifth weekend, dropping another 48%. With $1.9 million. It lost almost 600 screens, so it's kind of starting on its last gasps there. It's at $56.6 million domestic, $62.4 internationally for $119 million global cum so far. Against the $75 million budget, that one just isn't going to get there, despite stellar reviews. Number nine, we had Saturday Night, the Saturday Night Live movie. That made $1.8 million, dropping 47% in its second weekend of wide release. A lousy $770 per screen average there. This one has fallen pretty fast and probably isn't gonna get where Sony was hoping it was gonna go. And at number 10, we had in the second weekend of the Nightmare Before Christmas re-release with $1.1 million. Pretty lousy per screen average, but it's amazing that this one continues to earn for Disney all these years later. The other thing that I would like to highlight is Anora. One of the best reviewed movies of the year had its limited release in just six screens this weekend. It made $550,000 for a stellar 91,000 per screen average, which was one of the best of this decade so far. So wow. That one is off to a very, very, very good start in its limited release. So Neon is handling that one domestically. So it's probably going to go the Everything Everywhere All at Once route, where it goes, you know, a few more theaters next week and then kind of continues to expand. But Anora is definitely something we want to keep our eyes on here.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. 100%. Man, that's a killer per screen average. I don't know. I'm trying to remember the last time I heard one that high.
I would believe Wes Anderson's Asteroid City was around. It had a ridiculous, per screen before it expanded. Okay. That's the last one I can recall, but that is exceptionally high. So it's doing very well.
Gotcha. Okay. So let's talk about Smile 2. I don't think you and I have had the chance to see this film yet, but I know that a lot of folks on Slash Films staff have seen it and enjoyed it. And the general sentiment that I get is that it's better than the first movie, which a lot of people liked. So Chris talked about it on an episode of The Water Cooler last week. So if you missed that, you can go back and listen to his thoughts on that film there. Why do you think this movie performed as well as it did, Ryan?
Well, I think there's several reasons here. But so first off, I should mention it also did $23 million overseas. So it's got a $46 million global start. The domestic was pretty much in line with what the first one had done, because the first one did like 22.6, but overseas it opened to a little less than 15 million last time, so it did better overseas. The first one finished with $217 million worldwide. It had incredible legs. So I don't know if this one will have legs as long, but the thing is, the first one had a $17 million budget. This one had a $28 million budget. So first and foremost, I must compliment Paramount Pictures on, yes, you go slightly bigger with the budget for the sequel, but they didn't overdo it. So at $28 million with a $46 million global start, you're, even if you get to $100 million worldwide, which seems like the absolute floor at this point, you're completely safe and in good territory. So I think the first thing I would say is that Paramount was very smart and not sort of overdoing it. Second thing I would say is what you hinted at is that the response thus far has been great. Both the audience score and critic rating on Rotten Tomatoes are a little bit higher than the first one. And the first one got a B- cinema score. This one got a B cinema score. So the word was like, hey, we like the first one. Hey, we like this one even more. That's kind of been the sentiment. The other thing that I would like to point out is that what's interesting about this is that Smile came out in 2022, this 2024, so pretty quick turnaround. We've seen a lot of sequels that take years to come out, and luckily Paramount kind of put the, you know, brick on the gas pedal here. But what's interesting is that Parker Finn, instead of doing, you know, the same characters, same setting, more of the same, it's a new cast, a completely new setting, a whole kind of new idea within this, like, with the same sort of terrorizing thing in the background. And I think that in this, you know, sort of era where people are kind of craving original things and horror seems to be the only place where people will put their money where their mouth is, where an original horror thing can break out, even though this is a sequel, it does seem to be benefiting from the notion that it is also an, like, kind of another original story in a sense.
Yeah, it's, and not, this one's a musical too. So, like, genre wise, it's a little bit different as well.
Yeah, it's a musical in the way that Trap was kind of a musical. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like a, but yeah, it centers on like a pop star. So it's all very different. And it, so I do think that like it, that probably resonated with people, and that like it's, so not only is this a new horror franchise and not just a regurgitation of something that happened before, it's the sequel is not just spinning its wheels. And so I think that all sort of fed into it. Plus, the last and most important thing here is that the Halloween season, even casual horror fans who don't like make their way out to theaters all the time, this is the time of year where people are looking for an excuse to go see a horror movie. And because we have Venom coming out next week, this is sort of the de facto horror choice for the season. Now, Terrifier 3, yes, is going to continue to make money, but that isn't for everyone, and it's been marketed as it's not for everyone. So there are people who don't want the extreme gore, where this R-rated, still pretty scary, relatively extreme horror movie has become the safe quote-unquote option for the season. Mm-hmm. So that sort of helped as well, as that Paramount kind of got to plant their flag and go, we are the Halloween movie this year. And so it all sort of fed into this, you know, this really nice opening weekend for the movie. Like, again, it didn't like blow up, it wasn't a breakout sequel or anything, but it doesn't have to be. We don't have to measure everything against breaking records. You know, so that's sort of important to remember in these situations.
Excellent. All right, well, let's take a break and then we'll come back and continue talking about some box office stuff.
At your job, do you ever have to deal with a nose roller? How about a snub pulley? Well, if you're installing a new conveyor belt system, dealing with the different components can sound like you're speaking a foreign language. Luckily, you've got a team ready to help. Grainger's technical product specialists are fluent in maintenance, repair, and operations. So whenever you want to talk shop, just reach out. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Okay, so one thing that from the top 10 that you ran down earlier, Ryan, that I thought was notable was The Wild Robot is in the number 2 slot still. And that was notable to me because the movie is now available on, I guess it's PVOD, right? Like, you pay whatever it is, $20 to rent it or something. And so for this movie to have such great word of mouth and make that much money in theaters, and we know... Well, we don't know. That's a big part of this conversation, is we don't know how much money any of these movies are really making on PVOD and all of that kind of stuff. The studios have kept those numbers really, really close to the vest. So I don't even think there are any like loose reporting sort of rumors about like this movie made X amount of dollars or something. I think those numbers are really, really like under lock.
There are charts. You can see like the iTunes charts, the Vudu charts. You can see like what the number one movie is at the moment or whatever, but that's about it. So, you know, it's, yeah, there is no hard numbers.
Right. So I just thought it was notable that the movie is still number 2 at the box office, but it's also available on PVOD for people who, I don't know, for whatever reason, don't feel like, or didn't feel like going out to the theater to see that one.
Yeah. So look, this is one of those things where there's kind of a division within box office punditry right now. And I think a lot of you listeners probably know where I fall on this one, and that, like, yes, The Wild Robot is still doing very well in theaters despite being available on VOD. So people on the other side of the aisle would tell you, well, after a certain number of days, why does it matter? Right? Because the people that want to go see it in the theater will, and the people that want to watch it at home will. And I think that VOD is an excellent secondary revenue source. I think that with these big movies that, you know, look, something smaller, like an indie that is going to theaters for a week or two to try and drum up some, you know, awareness, that's different. But when we're talking about a big animated movie from Universal and DreamWorks, I still think, much like with The Fall Guy earlier this year, and much like these other conversations I've had, there still needs to be there's an importance in signaling that, no, this movie is worth seeing in theaters. And we know that, and we're going to hold that, and we're going to sort of plant that flag. So I'm glad this one waited almost a month, but I do think that you still need at least that 30-day exclusive window for something that's performing, and, you know, up to 45 days for something that performs extremely well. Mind you, that still would have been unthinkable 4 years ago, you know, so that's still great. But Yeah, so I don't know. So I'm of two minds about this, that, you know, because Beetlejuice, you could argue, is in a similar boat. And, you know, so I don't know. I think, like, when you have something like, you know, Borderlands that just bombs completely, I mean, obviously you got to do what you got to do. You're running triage at that point. But, yeah, I don't know. I mean, look, the data suggests VOD doesn't seem to be taking anything off the table, but I would argue that it's still important for the industry to signal that, no, this is a theatrical movie. You see it in theaters, and we're going to, that's how you do it for a first little while. Yeah. I still think that's important. I still think that's the signal that needs to be sent. Call me stubborn if you must, but that's what I believe.
Yeah. Sort of like conceptually, I agree with you, because of what that represents and what it means about the, or what it signals about the quality of the movie. And, you know, just like historically, it just seems like maybe the more, I don't know, fiscally responsible thing to do, which then could make enough money for a studio to justify spending it on other, you know, potentially original projects or things that we would be maybe even more excited to see or whatever, which is kind of like why we spend all this time talking about this stuff in the first place anyway, right? So I'm kind of like conceptually on the level there, on your level there, but I do wonder, because Universal has been doing this for, like you say, 3 or 4 years now at this point, they clearly have the internal data on how well this stuff has been doing for them and how much money they've been making. And I think if they, you know, they've had enough of a test period here in this sort of post-pandemic era of like, and the pandemic, the primary early days of the pandemic, to say, okay, if this isn't really working for us financially, we should shift back to the model that you're describing of like really hold things until the last possible second and try to fully prioritize the theatrical experience. But Universal isn't doing that all the time. So they're sticking with this method, which must mean, it signals to me that they're making a lot of money on PVOD.
They are.
And so it's just kind of like, you know, should they take a stand for capital M movies and the industry as a whole, or should they do what's best for them as a company that can potentially, like I said, make this money that they could then turn around and put into making more things that we want to see? So it's kind of a tough spot for them, I imagine.
My argument is that they're doing what looks best on paper for them right now. I'm arguing that they need to invest in the future. Because my other argument is that once these things hit VOD, once Avatar 2 hit VOD, once Top Gun Maverick hit VOD, these are the extreme examples, but once the Batman hit VOD, they were still number one on the charts on VOD. They were doing gangbusters VOD business anyway. And then they were, you know, so it's like, I don't think you're losing VOD customers by keeping it in theaters longer. Hmm. You know, I think Universal could still make a killing with VOD? Absolutely. I think that they probably believe that there is value in, you know, kind of merging those windows a little more and kind of capitalizing on the marketing that already exists. And I get that. But yeah, I think there's value for not just the industry at large and capital M movies, as you said, but for the health of their business later. You know, that's kind of the way, you know, because like Oppenheimer was sold out on Blu-ray for weeks on Amazon. When was the last time you saw that happen? You know, demand is still, people are still going to want it once it's available. It almost, if anything, is like, you know, in some cases it can create like almost like a, like an artificial more demand, you know, in some, you know what I mean? Where it's like, oh man, mm-hmm. it's been a while. Wow. I really want this thing now. So, you know, I don't know. Look, that's, I have whatever data I'm allowed to see. I don't have all of their VOD numbers. I'm sure they are very impressive, but I would still broadly make that argument based on people I've talked to, the decisions I see people making, it's fine for me to wait for streaming because they know it will come. You know, I just think you need to fight against that still. So that's, I can spin my wheels and go on and on about this, but that's just what I believe.
No, fair enough. I mostly was teeing you up to give you an opportunity to explain your position on this.
No, but you're also not wrong. Like, I should mention that. Like, you're not wrong. The numbers would probably, like, if Universal was willing to show me the numbers to get me to shut up about this, like, I it would almost seem stubborn, but I might still dig my heels in. So I should point out that I'm, anyway, so, but yeah, you're not wrong.
Okay, so you mentioned before we started recording that you wanted to run down the global top 10, which we haven't done in a while. So I'm not sure if you want to do that now, or if there were any other, I guess, stories from the domestic top 10 that you thought were worth any discussion.
You know, we probably should mention real quick that the Apprentice, the Donald Trump biopic, kind of fell off a cliff this weekend as well. It fell to number 13, dropped like 58%, horrible $601 per screen average. The other thing that was interesting, and partially because Joker 2 fell off so badly, is that Deadpool and Wolverine got one last gasp. It added 535 screens this weekend. Had a terrible per screen average, but it made $679,000. That's important because it ended up passing Barbie's domestic total from last year, giving it the number 12th all-time domestic total. So Deadpool and Wolverine passed Barbie as this weekend, which was kind of interesting. I think that's it. We should probably definitely pay attention to We Live in Time, and we'll probably talk a little bit about that more in the coming weeks. And Anora is kind of one of those, like, award season is upon us moments, and so again we should definitely pay attention to that in the weeks that follow, but for right now, yep, there's not much else to say other than that, you know, big per screen average. But yeah, as Ben mentioned, I you know, we haven't talked about it for a bit, so I just like to every once in a while just to sort of, you know, especially as we're kind of entering the fall season here, sort of look at, okay, what does the global top 10 look like now? And these are all North American releases, by the way. I don't believe this list changes if we include like Chinese releases and stuff, but so for now, the global top 10: Inside Out 2 with $1.69 billion worldwide, Deadpool and Wolverine with $1.3 billion, Despicable Me 4 with $963 million, which is just insane that that movie slow rolled its way there. Number 4 is Dune Part 2 with $714 million. Number 5, Godzilla X Kong The New Empire with $571 million. Number 6, Kung Fu Panda 4 with a very respectable $549 million. That's another one that kind of snuck up on people. Number 7, Beetlejuice with $434 million. Number 8, Bad Boys Ride or Die with $404 million. Number 9, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes with $397 million. I am still imploring Disney to re-release that just to get it over the $400 million hump. And at number 10 would be Twisters with $370 million, the vast majority of that coming from domestic audiences. So I do think that is a pretty interesting top 10. And I think a lot of those movies maybe we would have assumed would be in the top 10 this year. I don't know that the order is as we would have assumed. And I think that it is a kind of fascinating picture of what's happened this year, that for my money.
Yeah, a lot of sequels still in there, I guess, which is not really super surprising. But yeah, I guess, like, what's your takeaway on this snapshot of the top 10, I guess, as we're heading into award season? Is there anything really surprising in there for you?
Well, I was actually curious. There is one thing I have, but I was curious for someone who doesn't follow this as much. Reading that down, I'm guessing you haven't thought about this in a minute. Is there anything that stands out to you?
I'm trying to think if there... I mean, not really, I guess, because these movies kind of like made their mark in the moment, and we talked about them so much in the weeks surrounding and leading up to them that, like, it kind of makes sense to me that these things are where they are on the list, if that makes sense.
It's not, yeah, that does make sense.
Podcasting, but yeah, I mean, I guess, like, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, I'm kind of surprised is that high on the list, because that's one where I feel like, I don't know, that there was, I liked that movie a lot, and I feel like everyone that I spoke to liked it, but it didn't seem like there was a ton of, I don't know, how would I describe this? A ton of, like, deep dive interest into a thing. Like, sometimes at Slash Film, we'll go, like, all in on a movie and, like, write, you know, a billion articles about it because readers are clearly interested and, like, searching for stuff. And we're just like, all right, let's try to facilitate whatever anybody's looking for. Let's provide them with an answer, right? That's kind of, like, what we're doing these days. And so Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes didn't really seem like that type of movie to me. It seemed more like, yeah, let's all go to the theater and just watch something that is like a kick-ass good time. And so for a movie like that to be in there amid something like Despicable Me 4, which obviously is not going to have that level of interest, but it's a family movie, so it's like, that's a whole different calculus, you know? And same thing with Inside Out 2, you could say. So for a movie like Planet of the Apes to, in my view, sneak up there into the top 10 is maybe the most notable thing, but I don't know.
Yeah, no, that is interesting, and I still wonder if they greenlight the sequel, if it's going to be like a Dawn of the Planet of the Apes thing because of the way that movie ends, where there is more interest in the sequel, or if this was kind of it, and then like the sequel sort of, you know, fizzles. I'd be curious. The one thing I will say, the award season race seems very uncertain right now. I think there's some sense of what actors are going to be in the mix, but I think the Best Picture race is as open as it's been in a long time. And I think the one thing I would point out is this. I think heading into the year, Warner Brothers probably guessed they would be backing Joker, Folie à Deux, and Dune Part 2, given what happened with the first Joker. I got to imagine they are backing way off of Joker now, which means they're going to put their muscle behind Dune Part 2. There is a strong chance that you could make the argument that Dune Part 2 is in some ways the front runner for Best Picture right now. And, you know, I don't know how true, but I think that looking at what's available now, maybe, you know, Oppenheimer proved last year that the Academy will award a huge, you know, it was the first time in like 20 years that an outright blockbuster won Best Picture. So it's possible.
Yeah, I think the one downside there is I think I've, from a lot of the awards pundits and stuff that I've followed and listened to and whatever, they've said that because Villeneuve, the director, Denis Villeneuve, the director of these Dune movies, has basically come out and said, oh, I'm going to be filming Dune Prophecy, Dune Messiah, the third part of this trilogy. Because he's done that, the Academy has historically been hesitant to award big movies like that in like the number two slot of a trilogy. And like they look at Return of the King as the big example of like they didn't really give the Lord of the Rings movies much love Oscar wise but then Return of the King came around and just like did effectively like a full sweep, you know. So
yes,
so that could be a factor there, but I definitely understand your larger point of like WB not having Joker to put its chips behind and saying, okay, let's actually devote all of our, a lot of our resources to pushing Dune Part 2, which is a great movie. And I would love to see be like a serious, legitimate contender for Best Picture. So we'll see if that actually ends up happening.
I will say the last thing I would say there is that he's kind of made it clear that Dune Messiah is not necessarily going to be like Dune Part 3. Like it's kind of almost going to be its own thing. You know, just because of I haven't read the books, but my understanding is that it kind of ventures off and, you know, so I don't know how effective that messaging could be at changing the narrative for the Academy, but that would be the only sort of thing where I think if Warner Brothers could effectively message that, you know, maybe. But anyway, that's about all. One last thing I did pull up is that ComScore updated the overall box office for the year is down 11% compared to the same point in 2023. That's not great, but as some of you will recall, as we were heading into the summer in May when things were looking very bad, we were down, I think, as much as 26% at some point.
I was going to say, 26, 27 was the number I had in my head.
Yeah, so we've made up a lot of ground. Now, 2023 is still going to finish under, but, you know, we could be less than 10% under by the time it's all done. So that, I mean, you know, that's hard to totally complain about. So that's the last thing I just wanted to point out is that, you know, the bulk of the collective effort of everything that's happened since May has lifted the picture quite a bit. So,
yeah, excellent. Okay, cool. Well, that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find more about all the stories that we mentioned on today's show at slashfilm.com. I will try to link to a couple things in the show notes as well. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really helps us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk to you all tomorrow.
If you're a facilities manager at a warehouse and your HVAC system goes down, it can turn up the heat, literally. But don't sweat it. Grainger has you covered. Grainger offers over a million industrial-grade products for all your operations, including warehouse HVAC maintenance. And even better, they offer access to experts and fast delivery, so you and your warehouse can both keep your cool. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.